All right, welcome to class today. My name is Luther Tykonovich. I am substituting for Charles Rice while he's at a conference. And I'll do my best. It's always a little tricky with substituting to know if I match exactly where you left off last time, but we'll make through and we'll do our best. I understand that you recently had a quiz with a fairly low average. I didn't write the quiz. I can't guarantee to know everything it says, but I'm happy to talk about it or other questions if you want. Is there anything any questions you would like to ask about the quiz or other things? Yes.
You have a question four.
Can I go over question four? I can certainly try. Question one, question two, question three, question four. Oh my, so much information. I don't feel like reading all the meta information, so I'll trust you to tell me if it was important. We have the C code. All right, I've got an array of 280, that's an odd number, characters, which I'm going through 10 times all of them, yes? And setting them all equal to 1. Okay. If I have a direct map, 256-byte cache with 64-bit blocks, and write allocate write back policy, how many cache misses will occur? And apparently this is unlike lecture, but fortunately I wasn't in lecture, so that won't trip me up. All right. So, how do I go about this problem? So, I need to figure out cache misses. This means I need to figure out which things hit cache lines. Fortunately, I have a direct mapped cache. So this is deterministic. There is no least recently used. There's no anything like that I don't have to worry about. I just have to figure out what cache line each memory access goes to. I'm going to assume that all those bullet points at the front tell me that things are aligned nicely with cache lines. Otherwise, I couldn't answer this question. If I'm wrong, let me know. But let's figure out first what a cache looks like. We've got 256 bytes in 64-byte blocks. That means I need to have 4 blocks in order to get to that size cache. Okay, 4 blocks. And now I just need to figure out where each of my memory accesses go. That is outer loop, which, okay. Well, let's start with the inner loop. So let's suppose I'm going through the first time. When j is 0, I know that I'm going to have a cache miss, but I also need to figure out where, which cache line I am going to. Does the information before this help me know which cache line I'm going to? I'm seeing some yeses and some I don't knows. Okay, maybe we should find out. All right. We only access the array to use the data cache specified. And the data cache is initially empty, so we're going to have misses. And address of 0, array 0, is a multiple of 2 to the 20th power. Ah, this is the magic I need. 2 to the 20th power. It's a multiple of 2 to the 20th power, which means the bottom 20 bits of the address are all 0. Remember how my addresses get turned into a set index for my direct map cache. I'm going to take my address. I'm going to need some number of bits for the block offset. How many bits do I need for the block offset?
6.
Where did you get 6?
64.
Yep, the log base 2 of 64. So I'm going to have 6 bits for the block offset. The next thing in a direct map cache is the block index or line index. I need enough to get all of the lines. I have 4 lines. This is going to be 2 bits. And then the rest of this is going to be the tag. So I know, since I'm starting at something with 20 0 bits at the bottom, these bottom 8 bits are guaranteed to all be 0. As well as more things beyond them, also 0. Right? So that means I know that I'm going to have the set index of 0, and I'm going to be going to the first byte in that thing. And it's just 1 byte because I have a character array, 1 byte values. So I now have 1 miss. I have 1 miss so far. Then the next 63 things will all be hits. Because the next 63 things will just walk down this block. So I'm going to get 63 hits. And that gets me up to J of 64. J of 64 is going to set this block in the set block index to 1. And so now I'm going to get 1 more miss. We'll do tick marks for that. And I'm going to then get 63 more hits. And then I'm going to go to the next line, and so I'm going to get a third thing, and 63 more hits. And then I'm going to get a fourth thing, and 63 more hits. That has brought me up to J of 256. J of 256 is going to have a set index or block index of 0. And that is because 256 looks like this. Right? So I'm back to block index 0. Block index 0 is already in use. Is this a hit? No, it's not, because I have a different tag. So I'm going to evict that line and get a fifth miss. I'm going to go from 256 up to 279. So I'm not going to go all the way through that. 256 to 279 is 24. How many is that? 279 minus 256 is equal to 23, 24, 23. I'm trying to remember if I round or not. So I'm going to end up with my first run through the loop. These are going to be my hits and misses. Questions about the first run through the inner loop? All right, then I'm going to come around to the I loop and go for the second run. It's going to be similar, but not the same. Zero is going to be a miss again. I'm going to have to evict this one that had the tag ending in zero and put in something with the tag ending tag ending 1 and put in something with tag ending 0. So I'm going to have a miss on the first row. But the second, third, and fourth rows are going to be hits all the way along. So where I got 5 misses the first time, I'm only going to get 2 misses the second time. I'm going to get for 0 and for 256 will be in conflict with each other, so they'll both miss. Everything else will hit. And so I'll just get 2 more misses the next time, and that will repeat for the remaining 9 times. Give me a total of 18 plus 5 is 23 misses. Let's see if I got the same answer that Professor Rice did. I did! Amazing. All right. Questions? Other questions about the quiz or other things? Okay. Now I understand from Professor Rice that the two sections ended in slightly different places on last week, but I actually don't know where the two different places were. Did you talk about cache blocking? Is this a phrase that was discussed in class last week? Yes, we talked about cache blocking. No, we did not. Okay, clearly we did not. So I'm guessing that's where I should start. So let's look at this page, this here. I understand you've looked at matrix multiply several times. I decided to make an animation. This is just what gets accessed in this matrix multiply. And I'm just running it at 2 frames per second. Okay? So before I start talking about how this works, questions about my picture here. Things I should clarify about what's happening. Let's speed it up, shall we? All right, so this is our naive matrix multiply code that we've been talking about, as I understand, for several weeks now, or at least several days in this class. And we ended last time talking about caches. So, what would be the if this causes a lot of cache misses, if I have a lot of cache misses, where will they appear? Which of the three matrices will get the most cache misses? R. Why R? What is it about R's access pattern that suggests we'll have more misses than the others? It's going to a new item every time, although so is L. Yeah, it just always stays in the same row. But every single iteration is a new value. So why is a new row better than a new column? Or new column rather than, yeah.
In this implementation, we've stored rows next to each other, so it can take advantage of the
Yeah, our cache lines are horizontal because we decided to store our matrices in row major order. We could have decided to store our matrices in column major order, in which case our cache rows would be vertical, but then we'll just switch which one was the problem. It wouldn't save us anything big. So, just to remind ourselves, I have here 16 values, so as I go here from index 0 to 15, index 16 then is on the next row, right? And I believe he usually showed you some code actually had the multiplication to make that more explicit. I'm more used to the double index form. Hopefully that isn't too confusing. So let's see what would happen if we just actually start trying to draw some cache lines. So I'm going to say, all right, let's slow this back down. Let's suppose I want to have, 16 lines in my cache. Here are the lines that each of my accesses is using. But I can only store 16 in. And so you'll notice that indeed, almost everything I am doing, clearly D has great locality. It has perfect temporal locality. I access the same memory access over and over and over and over and over again until I'm done with it and never come back. L has great spatial locality. I am accessing a different value every time, but I'm not moving very far. And I'm always moving to something else in the same cache line or the next cache line, depending on how big my cache lines are. But R, ugh. Unless I have enough cache lines to do the one line for every row of my matrix, I have a huge number of misses. As we're seeing counting up here, I have hit more cache misses than I have had cycles. Okay? So this is a problem, because a cache miss is slow. Depending on which cache misses, it might be only slowing me down by a factor of 3 or slowing me down by a factor of 300. Depending on what's the L1 cache that's missing or the L4 cache that's missing and how many caches you have. So this is making my code very slow by having all of these cache misses in R. How could I make this better? Let's try just giving ourselves a bigger cache. How about that? Let's just say we have 9 elements per cache line. Okay, this isn't actually helping me any. I get these weird wrapping cache lines, but okay. Let's say I have 16 elements per cache line. I'm going to have an entire row in my cache line at a time. I'm getting a slightly fewer misses in L, but it's not going to change R at all, because I'm still wrapping around. Oh dear. Okay, maybe I'm not going to make bigger cache lines. Maybe let's just try making more cache lines. Let's say 32 cache lines. That should fix things for us. And now I'm getting some more hits. Huzzah! But it turns out that I can't just arbitrarily make arbitrarily big caches. Right? I can't just say, ooh, for this problem, I want a gargantuan cache. Because as the cache gets bigger, it also gets slower. It's not that I can't make bigger caches. It's that by being bigger, it takes longer to look them up. So caches have to be small to be fast. So sure, I can make a bigger cache to fix things, but that's not going to get me very far. So I need to change something about how I am accessing data. I need to access data in a different pattern. Let's actually erase the cache lines for right now. So as I look at this code, the problem is R. R does too many distinct rows before repeating. And so if I need to fix it so that R does fewer rows before repeating, if I don't make R do fewer rows, I will still have cache misses. So somehow I have to change my code to make R not go all the way from top to bottom before repeating. Okay? So how can I do that? Well, I need to change my code. First, I have to figure out which loop is dealing with the vertical part of R. And I see that R's row index is I. So I'm first going to refactor my code in a way that's going to do nothing to it except it make it look uglier. I'm going to split this loop in half. Let's do it this way. I'm going to make 2 I's. I'm going to have II, which is going to go up by 4s, and I, which is going to go up by 1s. I assert that this new code, which I have not started running yet, we will in a moment, is identical to the old one in functionality. Let's consider the values. Clearly, I haven't changed R and C, so that's good. And if we look at I, what will I do? It will go 0, 1, 2, 3, and then we'll go to the next II and go 4, 5, 6, 7, and then the next II and go 8, 9, 10, 11. So I'm going to have the same sequence of I's that I had before, 0 through 15. I just have two loop overheads handling this. I'm going to check the loop twice to make it work. So we can verify this by running this code instead. And I've got exactly the same behavior. I want to get the same behavior before I change the behavior because I want to make sure I'm not breaking the code. But now that I've got four loops instead of three, I can play around with their order. If I move this line above the line above it, those lines share no variables. It should not change the functionality of my code in any way. So let's just see what happens if I move this line up one. So I split one loop into two loops, one that went in big steps, one that went in little steps in front, and then I just changed the order. And now we're going to go see what this code does. Why is it doing this? It is doing this. My simulation is actually running the code shown. I didn't do any magic here, but why is this the access pattern? What's going on? Yes.
Yeah, for every column, you're like going through four values, and then it goes back to the, and it's done to the four, and it goes up to the next column, and so on and so forth.
Yeah. So notice what's going over here in D. D is running along a row, because I'm still iterating one load at a time, but then it's going to run along that row again and again and again. Because it has to go through that row many times, looping through the columns once for each II. So it's going to loop through each of those things four times. Instead of doing them one at a time, it's spread that out. And R, you'll notice, is doing a little group of four times in a row. Right? So it says, all right, here's the first group of four, then the second group of four, then the third group of four, and each of those run through them. But this is causing over here, because I just had runs through four things at a time, I'm going to only look at four rows at a time. Yes?
It is still the same functionality, right?
It's exactly the same functionality. Right? I haven't done anything to change the functionality. I split a loop in two loops without changing its behavior, and then reordered loops that didn't share variables. So that didn't change its behavior either. All I've done is change which order I'm accessing memory in. Let's now look and see. Let's suppose I have my 16 lines again. Now I'm getting much better cache line utilization. When I load a line into R, I'm going to use that line once for every value in the line. I used to use it once, now I'm using it in this line's eight times. And so you'll see my steps are growing much faster than my misses. I still have a lot of misses. I could do better than this, but I have much fewer misses than I did before, roughly by a factor of eight. Counting exact misses is a bit of a trick, and it's a bit tedious to do, as you found out on the quiz. Okay? But as a general rule, my code is going to be more cache efficient if I use the same cache line more times before it gets evicted. And so this code is using each cache line in LR eight times instead of once. And so I expect to be roughly eight times more efficient in my cache utilization. Questions? Yes?
Would it be possible to like put another for loop?
Yes, it would. Where should we put it?
I mean, I don't know about that one.
I was going to have four loops.
Let's just do the same thing we did with I. Let's do it with every other loop, shall we? Why not? We've got loops to spare. All right, so let's take our R loop. We're going to do the same thing we did there. What did we do? We had one that went up by fours. And instantly, four is just a number I picked out of thin air. It didn't have to be four, although we'll talk a little bit more about why I picked four later. So now I split my R loop in half, and I'm going to split my C loop in half. So I'm going to have CC which is going to go up by fours. And this is going to go up to... All right. Ta-da! I turned my three loops into six loops. Don't do this in your software engineering class, by the way. All right. This shouldn't have changed the functionality. So let's just try enacting it. Yep. Here it is. Same thing I was seeing before. Great. But now I've got six loops I can play around with the order of. Whoa. Let's just move all of my double letter things to the front. Let's put them in for now in the same order they appear later on. I have weird indentation here, but anyway. So I split all my loops into a big step and small step. I put all my big steps first, all my small steps second, and now I run it. Okay, what is going on? I am considering 4x4 blocks of all three matrices. And for every 4x4 block of each matrices, I'm doing everything I would normally do for a matrix. So all four of them only need these 4x4 blocks. Right? Yes?
First of all, we're assuming that D, L, and R are using all different caches, right? Sure.
I'm not assuming they're using different caches. The total number of cache lines I have highlighted across all four of them is 16. And I can make that smaller. Should we try making it smaller? Let's see if we're going to have some cache conflicts. Let's drop it down to 6. This is just least recently used policies, what I have implemented under the hood. Okay, so every time I access in any of those, it becomes least recently used. And because R is changing a lot, I see it ends up with most of the cache lines. Where D and L aren't changing very often, so their line is less recent. Their past line is less recently used, and so I'm getting a lot more misses with fewer cache lines. You'll notice R occasionally has these little gaps. We see this little white thing spinning down, right? So I'm getting some misses still. I don't have enough lines to make this efficient, but I still have fewer misses than I had in the first version by quite a lot. I was having more than I have steps, and I've got something like a third as many. And as I add more cache lines, this will become more efficient. So at 8 cache lines, I'm basically just doing fine. I'm getting a few extra misses in L and D because I don't have enough to store all of them. But those aren't changing very often because they're the outer loops instead of the inner loops. Other questions? Yes? Great question. Are there no downsides to doing this? Somebody point out a downside to this approach. Yes?
Well, we did make the cache line bigger with 8 lines and 8 elements in the line.
Well, I started, the first version of the cache I had was 16 lines with 8 elements per line. Yeah, so actually with my original cache, I'm dramatically better. So that isn't the problem. Yes?
The nature of matrix multiply is that it doesn't matter what order you do the plus equals thing, but
true.
If it matters for whatever you were doing before, then you can't do
this. Yeah, so this depends on the fact that the plus is an associative commutative operator. That's why I can do it in different orders and get the same result. If I was not doing an associative commutative operation under the hood, then this operation, I have to be more careful to make sure I don't change something about it. Whatever it is, whatever property it doesn't have. So you're absolutely right. Not everything we'll do will have this. However, the basic operators that we use generally are associative and commutative. Division is not, subtraction is not, but addition, multiplication are. And many other things are bad out of this. So this turns out to work in a lot, but not all circumstances. There's another reason not to do this, though. Even if you can, maybe you shouldn't. I actually heard somebody say it quietly under their breath earlier. Why would you be upset? Why would you think your employer might be upset if they saw this code? Yeah. It's confusing. Who is going to look at your code more, the computer or some other programmer? If it's the computer, if we actually care about speed, then do this. If you don't care about speed, if you care more about humans, this is a bad thing to do. This is going to be a trend of optimizations. We're going to make uglier code that runs faster but is harder to understand and maintain. Yes?
Is this something that modern compilers will do behind,
Will a compiler do this for me? No, because of the point that was raised earlier. I am changing the behavior of the code. If my operators happen to be associative and commutative, the end result will be the same. But compilers will only make optimizations that will have the same sequence of actions at some level that a debugger can understand. And I definitely don't have that now. I'm traveling through these in very different ways. And so compilers, some of the other things we'll talk about later in class today, compilers can do for you, but this kind of thing it won't. You'll need to do it if you want it to happen. Other questions? There is actually one other problem here. I am currently only counting cache misses. But if I were counting instructions executed, those have gone up. Because once for every four values of I, I have to add 4 to I and compare I to N. So I've got an extra addition and an extra comparison once every 4 steps through the loop. And similarly for the others. So I have added I'm actually having the computer do more work. I'm just having it do work that I hope will be faster because I think the cache, rather than the computation, is likely to be my limiting factor. And so doing this when you don't need to will slow things down because you're doing more work. The work that is inside the parentheses of the for loop is getting repeated by having more for loops. And so there is a cost. And if I could figure out a way of doing this with only 2 extra loop up top or 1 extra loop, then that might actually be better for me. Right? So I might come in here and say, let's see if we can do this without the R. What does that one do? And we can try to see, oh, but I can't do that because I didn't fix this one. All right, let's fix this one. And I could try saying, is this actually better? Did I need to have that loop? And we could try to figure out, is this worth the overhead? Is the difference in cache misses worth what I'm doing? I also want to try to figure, I picked 4 out of thin air, basically, because it lines up nicely in this case. But I don't always want to do 4. I want to get sort of the biggest number I can that doesn't leave cache lines. Or that doesn't run out of cache lines. Because the smaller those numbers are, the more times I'm coming around. We can see that, actually. If we pick a really small number, let's pick, for example, 1. This is the smallest possible cache block. And now I'm back to where I started. I have 1-sized blocks, and so everything is a block. And each block does one thing. This is just clearly worse than I started. I have to do more work to do the same memory accesses. Right? And similarly, 16's no good, because that's the size of the matrix I gave you. Right? So this just says everything is 1 block. And it will also do the original work with extra overhead. Right? So I need to find some magical balance where I'm breaking the work into small enough chunks that I get good cache hits, but not so small that I'm wasting energy. And finding that is a little bit tricky. There's another trick that we could have. You know what? Let me actually do this block size here. Let's say our block size is 16 and make sure this will still work for me because I'm getting tired of changing all 6 numbers. All right. So here I have my code. It should still do the same thing. Great. What happens if this is not a factor of the size of my matrix? So here I've used 3. I have a 16 by 16 thing, and oops. Now for my visualization, that just looks weird. What will this do if you put it in C? You'll go off the edge of your array, which might seg fault if you're lucky. If you're unlucky, what will it do?
Nothing.
It'll just quietly change some other piece of memory. Right? That's what happens when you go off an array. Just go to whatever bytes are there. I don't know what bytes are there. C doesn't care. It'll just do what you asked it to do. If I'm lucky, I've gone to the end of a segment and I'll get a segfault. If I'm unlucky, I will silently change memory. Right now, you'll see it's going off the end there. Actually, that'll wrap around, so I'll get the wrong result as well. Right? So you need to be careful. You need to handle cases where maybe your matrix and your block size aren't factors of each other. And you can do that in various ways. We could constrain more fully where we bound things. We could do a little extra math, try to find different bounds. We could handle the edges separately once we're done. There's various tricks we could do to handle these cases. But it'll be easier if we can just fix something that actually is a factor of the size of our matrix. And we find that it is a factor of size or matrix, we don't have any special things to do, and our life becomes pleasant. Questions? Yes?
I've got like a random question.
Yeah?
Is it possible to use a third for loop, but for the same variable?
Sure.
That would be helpful. I'm just curious.
Yeah, I'm not limited in how I do this. Why would I ever want to chop a single variable into big chunks, medium chunks, and small chunks? The reason I want to do this is because my different caches are different sizes. So optimizing for the perfect block size for the L1 cache may waste space in the L2 cache, which is much bigger. And so I might want to have L3 size blocks with L2 size blocks inside of them, with L1 size blocks inside of them. In theory, this could give me even better cache performance by getting a higher hit rate in my farther back caches. Whether it will actually pan out in practice, where the loop overheads are worth the misses, is something that will vary depending on the actual configuration of your processor, how fast it can do each of those pieces. And the only way to actually know if that will work in practice is to time it. Other questions? Okay. So this is the strategy known as cache blocking. Just give a little summary of when you want. So it is only going to be cache blocking if you change the order of memory accesses. It's only going to be good cache blocking if you change the order of memory accesses in a way that increases cache hits or decreases cache misses. In general, the principle is take a local region and do everything you can with that before moving on to the next region. And we usually do that by splitting our loops up and then reordering them to some degree. And this is not the only way to improve cache performance. So if we go all the way back to where we started, and then I just swap the order of some loops, that won't help. Let's try swapping this loop. Nope, that's just changed which one that does. There is some order here. I can't remember which one it is. Maybe it's this one? Huh. This order, randomly, for this exact code, has fewer cache misses. Why? Yeah, the thing that's switching a lot is C. And C is only used in the horizontal axis. So the thing I'm switching a lot is the horizontal axis, the one that is going to have good spatial locality. I'm going to have better cache performance. It's way worse than our blocking was, but it's way better than our original ordering. It's a strange ordering. Nobody ever describes how to do matrix multiplication in this way. But it is valid, and it has a lower miss rate. So there's things besides blocking that can handle this. It turns out that picking different data types of different sizes and so on can also change your cache performance by lining things up with cache lines in different ways. So it's a complicated topic, but cache blocking is a useful tool for many scenarios. Any questions about cache blocking before we move on to a different topic? Or other questions about caching. The next thing we're going to talk about isn't going to deal with caching at all. Okay. Let me slow this down so it doesn't chew up my processor while we're looking at other things. Here's some code. Take a moment, look at this code, convince yourself you know what it's doing. I said we're not going to talk about caching anymore, but let's actually just verify that we're okay on the caching here. How is the temporal and spatial locality of this code? Or another way of asking, is there anything I could do to make them better? I'm seeing some puzzled looks. Can somebody either articulate their puzzlement or explain their thoughts if they aren't puzzled? Yes?
I believe this is, needs to access each element in values only once. So I don't think there isn't anything we can do to improve temporal locality since we're only accessing everything once anyway. In terms of spatial locality, I don't think there's anything we can do to make it better because we're accessing values in order, so that presumably would lead to the least amount of misses.
Great. I agree. Temporal locality, each value is accessed once, there's no temporal locality to add. Spatial locality, the best spatial locality is accessing adjacent elements, and it turns out because of prefetching, have we talked about prefetching at all? No. Okay. It turns out that in general, usually in this class we won't actually talk about how it works, but many memory is slightly more efficient if you go from smaller addresses to bigger addresses than if you go the other way. Because, I don't know, it turns out more code does that, and so you can make your caches slightly more efficient that way. So, this code is going forward through adjacent elements, accessing each once. It's as good as it can get in caching. But it's not as good as it can get. We can make this code quite a bit faster. To understand why, let's look at the assembly. Here is the same code. It is zeroing out a couple of values. It is comparing, let's remind ourselves what's going on, it's comparing something I just zeroed out to the second argument. What was the second argument? Second argument was the size of the array, something I just zeroed out. So that must mean I. So it must mean the EDX is being used as I. I'm comparing it to the size of the array. If it was less than or equal to the size of the array, I'm done. Okay? Otherwise, I have this magic right here. What does this magic right here do? Yes?
I think it's the address of the first element in the array and then it iterates through it.
So there's something to do with our addresses here. Although this is not an LEA access, this is an add access. So because I have parentheses, I'm going to memory. I'm going to memory at what address? I'm taking the addition of RDI and RDX times 8. Okay? RDI is the first argument. What was the first argument? The first argument was the pointer. So I'm taking the sum of the base address of the array and 8 times my index variable. The reason I'm doing 8 times my index variable is because my values are 8 bytes long. So this is the reason why this fancy memory address exists. And the reason why we have these things in the Intel architectures, because this is how we access arrays. So this is going to grabbing a thing from an array, and it's using it as an argument of add queue. So it's grabbing it from memory and adding it to RX in one step. Amazing. Incidentally, the system that you have designed in your pipeline and so forth couldn't do this in one step because you can't read from memory and then go to the execute stage. But Intel is fancier than your simulator. So it can. Then we are adding one to the index and repeating. So here's our code. All right. Let's think about this loop. This loop consists of 5 instructions. One of those instructions is doing the work of the loop. 4 of those instructions are keeping the loop running. That means 1/5 of the instructions are being productive in this code. And that is the source of inefficiency in this code. I have to run 5 instructions to do 1 piece of work. The other 4 are dealing with, effectively, handling the for loop statement. Right? And then I have 1 that's dealing with the work inside. I would love to do more work per iteration of the loop. How could I do more work per iteration of the loop? Yeah?
That's what it is. So inside the loop, you can make it so that your axis is, like, so in here, you could make it I plus equals 4, and then inside, you can make 4 instructions inside.
Ooh!
Values I, and then I plus 1, I plus 2.
All right. Like this.
Yeah.
What do we think? First question is this doing the same work as before? Will this ever give me a different answer? Yes?
It might go out of bounds, right?
It might go out of bounds! Oh no! Okay, that's fine. I can fix that. I just need to make sure the biggest index is in bounds. Now it will never go out of bounds. Now we'll always do the same thing? Okay, the case where I go out of bounds before would occur when my list was not a multiple of 4 long. If I give this code a 3-element list, what will it return? 0. Regardless of what's in the list. So I'm not quite done. I need to do some sort of cleanup at the end. But let's ignore that for the moment. Let's look at our assembly. I had this old assembly. I had 5 assembly instructions, 1 of which is work. Let's just make 2 of them work. Ta-da! Or 3 or 4 or however many you may want to make work. All right? And this is the idea we just saw. We saw it with 4 instead of 2. But this is what it looks like if we do it out with 2 and handle the leftovers. Except I don't have the right I here. So, if I do everything that's in bounds first in pairs and then do 1 at the end, then the end result of that is going to be that I have handled every element of the list correctly, but I've done them in pairs. And so for every 6 instructions of the loop, I have 2 that are doing real work. So instead of 1/5 is productive, I now have 1/3 is productive. And if I keep going, if I add 4 instructions, I'll have 1/2 of my loop is productive. And the other half is the loop overhead. And there's no upper limit. If I put 1,000 copies of the instruction, then I have 4 loop overhead and 1,000 pieces of work. And it'll be almost entirely productive. This is called loop unrolling. That's the name of this operation. Okay? And we call it loop unrolling because we think of a loop. The word loop suggests something is rolled up. And we're just unrolling it one step. We're running just writing out part of the loop explicitly and leaving the rest with the loop overhead. And this should make our code faster. This is something your compiler can do, although it tends to be remarkably conservative about doing it. It doesn't tend to do very much of it. Why not? What's the downside to large levels of loop unrolling? Yes? Sorry? More instructions. Why would that be a problem? So your program takes more space on disk. That's true. But disk is cheap. I don't really care. My programs, so I unroll all of my loops, and my program goes from being 300 kilobytes to 2 megabytes. Woo! There's still a reason not to do giant levels of loop unrolling. Yeah?
I don't want to write a million instructions.
I want to write a million instructions. Well, the compiler will do it for me. Yeah. So definitely the payoff decreases as I get bigger, right? 1 level of loop unrolling goes from 1/5 to 1/3. It almost doubles my productivity. To get the next doubling, I have to put a lot more things in there. So there certainly is a diminishing payoff. Yeah?
You have to constantly check it out.
I have to have more in the out-of-bounds case. So if my array is not big enough, I don't get a lot of payoff.
I was saying, like, if the instruction's more complex, then maybe it might not be as useful.
So I have more work being done, right? So this particular loop was interesting because the work was one instruction. If the work was more than one instruction, I start at a fairly high level of efficiency and will get less benefit out of it. There's actually a problem with long loops, though. I made fun of the idea of running out of disk space, but there's another kind of space that I can't make fun of. Your instruction cache. If my function body is bigger, it's going to take more cache lines in my instruction cache. If I get it really big, I might have to cache out the bottom lines before I get back to the top. Ugh. Right, so that's going to be a problem if I'm having cache misses in my code. So that's a really big, but even if it's just a little bit bigger, every cache line I take up for this function is a cache line I've evicted for some other part of my code. And so when this function returns, something else will have left my cache. So making my code bigger actually does slow down my program. Not necessarily in an always predictable way, but there certainly is some cost to making larger code. So at some point, I'm going to stop seeing a time benefit with increasing loop unrolling. All right. Here I have three pieces of code. I'm going to assert they do the same thing. The first one is a function you should be familiar with by now. It's the matrix multiply we've seen again and again. The second one comes right from what we were doing earlier. I have blocked K. I've done size 2 blocks, but I've blocked K. Right? So I have my KK that's going up by 2s, and my K that's going between those 2s, and I've spread them apart to get my blocking behavior. My third code, how did I get my third code from the other two? What happened there? Turn to whoever's near you and describe to them how the third piece of code is related to the other two. Here's my description. I unrolled the innermost loop of the second code all the way. I unrolled it out of existence. Okay? So it was doing two things. I just wrote those two things. So this third piece of code is both cache blocked and unrolled. I don't have to combine these, but it turns out it's not actually that uncommon. If I can unroll a loop till the loop overhead goes away, then I get perfect efficiency of my loop because there's no loop overhead. And blocking tends to be relatively small chunks, which are reasonably easy to unroll. So this is a fairly common, it's not universal, we don't always do it, but you'll see this from time to time when you're looking at optimized code. Question?
How do you go in that third loop? How do you go in like the third example? How do you go about like figuring out like the leftover stuff that like is still in bounds at the end?
Great question. Where is the leftover stuff in this code? So if n was odd, what will I have missed handling? Well, actually, I've overrun in this particular case because I don't have the kk plus 1. But let's suppose I fix that in all of them. I need to fix that instantly up here too, right? So if n happens to be odd, this misses the last values of k. So I have actually several options. One of the most common is I'm just going to handle that case separately. So I'm just going to do the part that I can do quickly, I'm going to do quickly. And then afterwards, I'm going to handle this very specific case. where n was odd and I'm handling the n minus 1. And I'll just have whatever loop works for me there. Part of the reason I want to do that is because I really don't want to fix it inside the loop. I don't want my fix to run over and over again. So I really want my fix to be outside the loops so that it only runs once, if I can. And so in general, our fixes will try to push down to the very end if possible. Other questions? Okay. So we can unroll. We can cache block. They are separate optimizations. Cache blocking reorders our memory accesses. Loop unrolling reduces the number of times we run the loop overhead. You can do them both. You can do neither. You can do either one. They are separate kinds of things. So here I have some more code. Both of these have some unrolling going on. One of them also blocks, and the other one does not. Which one has blocking? You're welcome to chat with your neighbors if you want. See if you can figure that out. Let's just take a vote. I think A has the blocking. I think B has the blocking. We generally think B. Huzzah! I also think B. As a quick check, if I wanted to check, if there is blocking, I must have changed the order of memory accesses. So I can check one of these and verify that it's accessing memory in a different order. So for example, A in this first one goes 0, 1, 2, 3. In this second one, it goes, I have double semicolons, how did that happen? Anyway, in the second one, it goes 0, 1, 2, 3. In this third one, it goes 0, 1, sorry, it goes 0, n, n plus 0, or n plus 1, n, it 2n plus 1, it's not doing anything like the same order. So the third one has changed the order of memory accesses. It's the one that's a candidate for blocking. And it's actually blocking because we have the big chunks on the outside, the small chunks on the inside, so it's doing it. Any questions about these ideas? All right. So let's go back to this code we are talking about here. We're unrolling a loop. Professor Rice timed this code at different levels of unrolling. And he timed it by counting instructions rather than wall clock time. Counted cycles and instructions. And here is results. I have an idea that 32 I copied down wrong, but anyway, it's in this neighborhood. So let's look and see what we see here. Let's start with instructions per element. We said 4 instructions of loop overhead, 1 instruction of work. But I'm seeing here a total of 4 instructions per element, not 5. So somehow the compiler was able to merge 2 instructions. And it turns out that Intel will take a compare followed by a conditional jump and turn them into 1 instruction under the hood without telling you. Ta-da! So it's actually 4 instructions, not 5. Huzzah. So here I see 4 instructions per step. So that means that if I have 2 work in there, I should now have 2 out of 5 should be work. And I indeed see 5 over 2 is my value. And 4 over 1, 5 over 2. Then for 4, so I have 3 instructions of overhead, 4 instructions of work. That should be a total of 7 instructions, 4 of which are work. And so this should be 7 divided by 4. And it's pretty close to that. As we keep going down, we will see roughly that. You'll notice there's actually this tiny overhead. This is the fact that there is something we do up front and something we do at the end. And it is actually costing cycles. And that's where that little extra rounding comes from. But besides the fact that it manages to merge two instructions, the instructions per element is exactly what we expected it to be. Questions on instructions before per element before we come back to cycles per element. Okay, now we see something really weird. I can somehow run 4 instructions in 1 1/3 cycle. Meaning I'm running somehow 3 instructions per cycle. This is not something I can do with pipelining, right? Pipelining fetches 1 instruction per cycle. So this is not pipelining. It's something more than that. I am somehow running 3 separate instructions, all being fetched and executed the same cycle. What? So this one is doing 3 instructions per cycle, but this one is only doing 2.5 instructions per cycle. And this one is only doing 1.5 instructions per cycle, and I'm going down to just 1 instruction per cycle as I keep going. I never get faster in this code than 1 piece of my array per cycle. Initially, I'm managing 3 instructions per cycle. As I get fewer instructions, I'm still doing roughly the same time. In this case, 1 level of loop unrolling helped, 2 didn't. Or, sorry, I guess I say 2 helped and 4 didn't, or however you want to think of it, right? More loop unrolling didn't help me anymore because I hit some kind of limit. There is something that's stopping my loop unrolling to work, and I'm doing multiple things at a time. So for the rest of today and over the course of Thursday, we're going to talk about how we're doing multiple things at a time and why this results in the limit we have, and finally get to how we would fix this. Okay, but before we do that, let me mention a terminology that the textbook and Professor Rice use, which is the latency bound. That 1 is the latency bound. And conceptually what's happening there is I have to do one thing before another, and so I have a minimum latency I can possibly achieve in my work. Let's look at that. Actually, let's look at in the assembly. It might be clearer there. My 2 add queues both are using RIX. I therefore need to finish the first add queue before I can start the second. So regardless of how many instructions I can do all at once, I still have to finish one before I can do the second. And so even if I could do all of the instructions at the same time by some sort of weird magic, I still have to wait, 1 and add, then the next add, then the next add, then the next add, then the next add, and that is the latency of creating my new value that is bounding the efficiency I can get out of this, even issuing multiple instructions at the same time. And so we're going to explore why that happens and how we get around it, mostly on Thursday. Today, we're going to start looking at how we get multiple instructions to run at once. Before we do that, though, questions about things so far? All right. Your computer is cleverer than the one you simulated. Hopefully this is not a surprise. Hopefully you would expect an entire industry to be able to come up with more things than we could have you do in a homework in a few weeks. So we're going to look at this. There are 2 new ideas that your processor has. And we'll actually mix them together, but we're going to initially talk about them separately. The first is called multiple issue. In multiple issue, I just fetch several instructions at once. I'm going to duplicate all of the logic in my processor. I'm going to duplicate all of the registers in each pipeline register bank. I'm going to double all the wires. I'm going to double all the processing, all the memory access. I'm going to double everything in my processor. And then when it comes time to fetch an instruction, I'm just going to grab more memory and I'm going to parse it into 2 instructions instead of 1. I'm going to send those 2 instructions through my pipeline together. This is the idea of multiple issue. Once we get out of order, it's going to become more complicated. But for the baseline, it's this simple idea. Grab several instructions, run several instructions through at the same time. There's going to be weird extras when it deals with dependencies. Our forwarding logic is going to become much more complicated because I have many more places to forward from and many more places to forward to. Roughly speaking, my forwarding logic is going to grow with the square of the number of issues I have. And so, because I have to compare all pairs of things to make it work. And there's a practical limit to how much I want to do this. There's also going to be this, because of this latency bound, there's going to be diminishing returns with more of it. And so most modern processors have roughly fourfold issue. They can run about four instructions at a time. More than that increases the silicon a lot, adds more heat and power usage, and gives relatively little payoff. And so most people have just sort of stopped at four issue. Incidentally, there are specialized processors that have much higher issue by constraining their domain, but we're not going to talk about them today. So, multiple issue. The other idea is called out of order. So we've just been talking about caches. One of the premises of caching is that the memory stage should be able to take a variable amount of time depending on which cache I hit in. How can I have a variable amount of time? The basic concept here is my memory logic is just going to let the rest of the processor know when it's done. And it'll just sit there, hang on to an instruction as long as it wants. It can stall forever, or for as long as it takes to go out to RAM, which is practically forever, hundreds of cycles. So let's consider this example. Let's suppose my memory step asks for 3 cycles. Well, the first, this is a single fetch, single issue, we'll come back to that later, but I grab this instruction, I start it through the pipeline, it stalls out. This next instruction depended on the result. And so it's just waiting for the result to appear. It needs that because it has to depend on R8 to move on. But then this next cycle, the idea of out of order is, I don't care that this instruction was stalling. I'm going to make it stall somewhere outside the pipeline. I'm going to have a special place to store stalled instructions so that I can still use my pipeline for other purposes. So I'm going to go and fetch this third instruction. It doesn't depend on either of the previous instructions. So I'm just going to run it. Notice I don't have a memory stage. As soon as memory has variable cycles, 0 is a variable value. So I'm just going to take 0 cycles for memory instead of 1, thus giving myself a little bit more efficiency. Okay? So I can go ahead and run my third instruction all the way through before I've really even begun my second instruction. And similarly, my fourth instruction and my fifth instruction don't really depend on the ones before. They can just go. I don't need to wait. But I do need to wait at some point. I need to make sure that my final stage commits in order. Question?
This is not pipeline, right? Because it seems like the last three just skip the memory stage.
I skip the memory stage because I'm allowing it to have variable numbers of cycles, including 0. So I spend between 0 and more cycles in memory. But otherwise, this is a pipeline. But it's also got this special stalling logic where I can keep using something while something's stalled. So this is more complicated than a pipeline, definitely. But it is pipelined. I know it's pipelined because fetch is being used at most once in each cycle. And once fetch is done, it can be used for the next instruction while the first instruction's in decode and so on. I see classic pipelining behavior right here. I just also see this ability to use something while something else is busy. Now, I have this special C stage called commit. Okay? What's the commit stage for? The commit stage is to make sure the values that finally get shown up to the outer world are the right values. Consider if I didn't have commit. Consider if write back was the last thing. I have 2 instructions, both writing to register 9. The earlier one finishes second, because it had to wait. So you notice this line, the write back for register 9, happens in cycle 8, where this one happens in cycle 7. I don't want to allow that to actually show up. I want to prevent it from making it into my register file before the other one has happened. So once I've done all of my work, before I actually commit it, I'm going to wait for everything beforehand to commit. And so instead of really putting in the register file, I'm putting in sort of like temporary fake register file kind of idea. We'll see how we really do this with register renaming on Thursday. Okay? But I'm going to hold on to that value, wait for everything before it to finish, and then put it out in the place where it belongs, so that from the outside, if I'm not part of the pipeline, I see every instruction being fetched in order and finishing in order. And the fact that there's some things going out of order in between is invisible to me because it's handled entirely internally. I'm seeing some puzzled looks. Can anybody put... Yes?
With the six cycle, that was only possible because MRQ is going to best M and XORQ is going to best D, right? Because there are two writes.
Oh, you're right. Sorry, I should spread out my write-backs. Thank you. Right, I can't use the same cycle twice. Do I have any other overlappings? I don't think I do. Yes? What if there was a dependency between... So I would need to stall like I am between the first two instructions. Right? But the idea of out of order is I'm going to manage to tweak my stalling so it doesn't occupy the pipeline. When you're stalling, we're going to pretend like you're not running at all. And we're going to do that by throwing thousands of registers at our processors. We'll see on Thursday. Yes?
If you're not committing until like the end anyway, then how does it actually like speed anything up?
Great question. What would this look like if I did the classic pipeline? Let's actually just try the pipeline you did in class with these same instructions. Okay? So this means that once something stalls, it's occupying that spot. So this thing can't decode until here. And this can't decode until here. And this can't decode until here. And notice that I am actually taking more cycles. Right, my write back is happening considerably later. Now for this particular thing, my commit still ends up happening in, I think, the same cycle. I think I did my spacing slightly wrong, but I think it's the same cycle here. So this particular example, it's the same, but you'll notice I have a lot more stalling based on the needing to wait for a pipeline rather than needing to wait for a functional unit. So if I were to combine this with having multiple memory stages, like I have for multiple issue, then I can make this dramatically quicker. I can have lower delay in what's going on. In principle. I don't always. This particular example, it's the same. But for other examples, if I have fewer dependencies or shorter distances between them, then I can have a different outcome. And, yeah, okay. Other questions? Yes?
What if the first, instruction of the memory queue stall M for 3 cycles?
Because it had an L1 cache miss. So I had to go to L2 cache, which in this case we're pretending took 3 cycles. Yes?
Can we say the commit for the second one if it's not out of order? Am I staying on?
Sorry, say what you mean?
Sorry, for the second one, if we're not doing it out of order.
Right, so if I don't have any reordering, I could remove the commits. Yeah. This, however, actually another thing to note here. Imagine there's another instruction after this that depended on things. All of the values I need for this first one are ready by cycle 9. In the second one, they're not ready till cycle 11. Right? And so if this wasn't the end of my instructions, this second one could keep going sooner. It has a lower overall latency. I'm only being bounded by these extra commits. Other questions? Yes.
So without an order, we can essentially skip a pipeline stage for some instruction.
No instruction is skipping a pipeline stage. Unless this pipeline stage itself is variable duration like memory, in which case they're just doing a zero cycle version of memory. But I could do that without reordering. Right? So you notice the second one doesn't have reordering, and I also made memory variable cycles, including zero. So that's something I can do. The nice thing I can do in out of order is I I don't occupy, right? So effectively what's happening here, is I'm effectively like stalled in my decode stage, waiting for decode to have the information it needs, keeping anything else from starting decode. And I suppose technically this would have to stall and fetch because decode would be occupied, which means this couldn't even fetch until after that was done because there's room for it, right? This is how I believe your pipe homework version of pipelining worked. Is you have to occupy some stage while you stall. If we can make them out of the pipeline, then we can reuse that stage for something else. Question? The C just puts them back in order. We'll talk a lot more about this when we get to register renaming and how this is actually implemented under the hood. But we won't get to that today because we only have 4 minutes left. Yes? Yeah, they don't stall in stages. They get pulled out of the stage to stall in some other holding place.
So multiple instructions could be stalling.
Yep. We're just going to take them out of the pipeline to stall them, bring them back in when they're ready to execute. Yes? Then why did we do it? Okay. So, if I end my instructions here, that's the case. But if I had another instruction after it, I'm ready to run that next instruction no later than instruction 9 here versus instruction 11 here. And I could make more instructions that you would see that compounds, right? I add some more instructions to the end of this, you'll start to see that paying off.
Oh, so you, for the out-of-order cycle, you can start fetching at cycle 5, but for this one, you need to wait more.
Right, right. Yeah. As we increase the number of dependencies, everything becomes less useful. Right? All of our efficiencies that we're doing at the hardware level are ways of trying to do things that don't depend on each other in parallel. When there are dependencies, we have to add all this fancy extra logic to do our forwarding just to not do worse than we started. Right? Roughly, right? So, yes, dependencies, code with high dependencies is just harder to optimize. And so we're going to have to actually change our code if we want to get past the latency bound caused by dependencies. Change our code so there are fewer dependencies in it. And we'll talk about techniques for doing that on Thursday. We almost have enough time to do it today, but not quite. Any other questions in our last? Yes? The latency bound, yes. The latency bound is this idea that the work depends on a previous work. Actually, let's do it here. I can't, no matter how much parallelism I get, I can't really start doing the math of this step until the math of this step is finished. Because this step is changing sum, which is an input to the next step. So even if I can do everything all at once, I can't do those two things at once. Because there's a data dependency between them. Right? They're not the only data dependencies I have. I also have a data dependency between I plus 4 and this. But it turns out those are sort of going to different variables, and so I can somehow get them to work in parallel. I can sort of compute the next I plus 4 while I'm doing the first set of inside the loops and parallelize things that way using out-of-order execution. But I can't do that for the sum because the purpose of the function is to get this chain of dependencies. And so I have this latency of my dependencies as an upper bound or lower bound on how much efficiency I can get here. I can't get faster than doing it that much. Other questions? In our last minute together. Yes?
So if you added all the values together first and added it to the sum, would that be different because then you don't need to access the sum multiple times before?
Yes, this is a correct preview of how we're going to get around this thing. If I'm not using the same variable for all four of these sums, then they stop depending on each other. So if I have four different places to put the sums, then those can now suddenly all be in parallel. And then I have to somehow figure out how to deal with the result of that. Right? And so that's how we're going to get around these latency bounds. Note, though, optimizations depend on each other. I needed to get some levels of unrolling before this will even matter. Because my first basic function is spending so much time on the loop overhead, it's only getting 1.3. I haven't hit the bound yet. And so often this will be the case. You'll do some optimization to get rid of some block, and that will make another optimization start to be valuable. Your cache blocking, so your cache misses are no longer doing things. Then you unroll your loops, so your loop overhead is now smaller. Now you've got rid of both of those. Now it's time to do another optimization. Maybe once you've done all of that, things are happening fast enough, your cache becomes a problem again, so do more blocking, and so on. So optimization is this iterative process of trying one thing after another, each of which will unload the next. So we'll talk some more about that on Thursday. I will see you all then.